I would really like to thank Andrea and the other organizers of this wonderful conference, Evan. And thanks for the opportunity to come out here and speak and share some of the results we've been finding. And also, thanks very much for organizing this wonderful weather. It's snowing in Boulder right now. I would like to talk about reionization, but I'd like to continue to make some of the connections to metal production that Jason has started to set up in his talk. And I would like to also emphasize some of the important areas to be targeted for future observations, and Jason's already brought up some. I'll just note this peripherally at the beginning that we kind of have a Hobson's choice here. You partly want to hope that as many ionizing photons escape as possible from these metal-free stars in the first galaxies, because you want them to impact reionization and pick up their unique signature from their hard ionizing radiation. On the other hand, you want as little to escape as possible, because it's the only way you're going to get a lot of these emission line signatures, because you want them to be trapped in the host halo. So it's got to be one or the other. Of course, the real universe is always in between, right? But you hope that it'll be unique enough for one or the other to work. I'll just throw up my list of collaborators, a lot of whom are in this room, with whom I've explored some of the problems I'll be talking about. So Jason's begun to set up some of these connections between star-forming regions, ionizing production, photon production, supernovae, and metals. But what are some of the ways? Now, he's already set up the what, why, how, but I'll go through again very quickly. We've been hearing how metals determine the very stellar IMF because they determine physically how the stars shine. And in a cyclical way, this determines what metals are generated for the next generation. They also determine the how of star formation. How do they cool and collapse? Jason's already mentioned the role of carbon versus iron. They play very different roles in the path that the primordial gas cloud takes in fragmentation. They also play a role in the when of star formation, as in when the IMF could segue from a primordial to a present-day form. There's also the issue of the feedback from stars and supernovae on local, meaning within their halo, and also extragalactic star formation. Do they trigger or suppress star formation near them? And can they create pathways for low-mass stars, such as we see in these metal-poor halo star studies, to form near primordial IMF? You can also use the two arenas of metals and ionization to normalize to one another to constrain the first star's IMF, and I'll talk about that a little bit. And finally, for a lot of observers, you observe in physically ionization states, and to go from that to an underlying gas metallicity, you need to know the background radiation field. So these are tied together in very real ways. I'll do a quick review of stellar evolution, although I think for this audience, I'm sure most of you are very familiar with this. The critical factors are, of course, the mass and initial chemical composition. The mass of stars are really the players for most of the effects that I'll be talking about, although for specific elements like carbon and nitrogen, especially nitrogen, for which you need the horizontal branch burning of intermediate mass stars, the mass of stars are really the players. As Jason has shown, as you decrease the metallicity, the mass of stars get hotter and bluer. You get out less metals, actually. And this fuel source for these stars is the PP chain and not the more efficient CNO cycle. So they're hotter and smaller and they emit harder radiation. For a present-day IMF, you have the so-called alpha elements like oxygen, neon, magnesium, silicon, and so on. They come from the short-lived massive stars, whereas elements like carbon and nitrogen are created mostly by longer-lived intermediate mass stars. So they're created on order, on timescales of order, fractions of a billion years rather than fractions of a million years or millions of years. And this was, of course, predicted by the folk song artists of the 60s. This graph has already been ably explained by Jason, but I just want to reemphasize the very different physical structure of metal-free stars. And he had this shown as a fiducial energy budget, and you see how the slow PP chain energy generation rate changes the structure of metal free stars. They have to collapse a lot more. And the real physical effect that this has, which Jason has also shown, I direct your attention just to the right side, is the incredible difference, particularly in the helium ionizing photon creation. Now, here, our referee made us calculate the Wolff-Rayet phase, although we're not really sure that these exist for metal-free stars, but they're in there. If some of you ask, well, what's the role of that phase for POP2 or POP3? And the fact I want to reemphasize here is that the hydrogen ionizing budget goes up by 60%, but the helium ionizing budget goes up by a factor of 100,000. And so this neat separation that we had, that, you know, stars do the hydrogen ionization, quasars do the helium reionization, which is certainly true for the late helium reionization epoch we see at Z for around 3. But at early times, POP3 stars, whether top-heavy or not, could have influenced helium reionization as well.
Absence of the CNO cores changed the convective criterion for the core on that. CNO cycle, stars usually very convective, and you know
it started actually more convective.
They're more convective. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that?
80% of the mass. I think it has more to do with the way that you really can't transfer radiation out past a certain rate. It's just so much you can
okay,
do. The temperature gradient can only be so steep. Right?
Okay.
So it's just the same old convective criteria that pushed out.
Some definitions. We've already heard what the VMS hypothesis is and what apparent stability supernovas. I just didn't want to descend into acronym hell and have people be blinking 20 minutes from now. I do want to emphasize how this 140 solar masses separates two mass regimes that have similar radiative properties, but somewhat different nucleosynthetic properties, as Jason has shown, and we can independently test these. And hypernovae in units of 10 to the 51 ergs are thought to have explosions energy anywhere from 1 to 100 times 10 to the 51 ergs and originate in progenitors greater than about 15 solar masses. This has some basis in theory, but I should reemphasize that there is some low redshift evidence for the existence of these objects, but to extrapolate to the first star's regime is currently still a big step. I mean, the metal-free regime is very special, and we don't know whether these objects could have existed, but there is some basis in low redshift supernova data.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right, because it's physically still the same sort of core collapse mechanism as a type 2 supernova. So my understanding is the partition is still the same. But yeah, the total energy is anywhere from 1 to 100 times 10 to the 51 ergs. So the data so far, and we've been hearing this last week, is that metals are seen ubiquitously in systems up to the highest redshifts, whether it's quasars, Lyman alpha systems, the IGM galaxies, and there's generally no evidence for a significant evolution in metallicity, and I think Juche had some graphs on that as well. Now, the other laboratory for us is these extremely metal-poor galactic halo stars, and now we're starting to get enough data and numbers that we can use them as a laboratory to test the first supernovae and how they generated elements. Continuing with the data for reionization from Gunn-Peterson studies, it appears the IGM could be in the last stages of reionization at redshift about 6. But from the WMAP CMB data, I'm sure all of you have heard of this, there's this extremely high Thomson optical depth detected. And this would not be compatible at face value if you had a very simple ionization history, basically a step function. But there's no reason for that to be the case because you could just, this is an integral number, a cumulative quantity. You could hide any number of hand-drawn ionization histories in this. I should emphasize that this generated a lot of work talking about multiple or partial ionizations of hydrogen and also helium, like I mentioned. The blue papers talk specifically about helium, which, although it's a maximum of a 16% contribution to tau, is still very important and interesting at the levels that we're talking about. Another possibility is a contribution of a few percent from X-rays from the first stars and quasars. quasars, and we've looked at this, and so has Peng O, which is also interesting because their mean free path is so much longer prior to reionization. So they could really do interesting things for altering the electron fraction of the IGM at high redshift. And I just want to say that these, like I said, most of you may know this already, but it's worth re-emphasizing that these two may not necessarily be inconsistent with each other because they're sensitive to different stages of ionization. Gunn-Peterson studies are triggered by a trace amount of neutral, whereas this is triggered by a trace amount of ionization. So they're not necessarily incompatible with each other. But it does seem to indicate, because all the other cosmological parameters are getting nailed down, if you have a very high tau, that you could have you might need a very high star formation efficiency at high redshift, high efficiency of generating ionizing photons, which is why people were looking to very massive stars, because they are just phenomenally copious producers of ionizing radiation. So here's some of this data. This is in carbon 4 versus redshift from Patini et al., showing a relatively flat evolution out to redshift of about 5. I just wanted to show you this. You've seen this already, but it's incredible in these metal poor halo stars how they've just essentially measured most of the periodic table. And looking at some of these elements again, this is from Sneeden and Cowan. It's interesting, I should say here, some of these are process elements. This black dots are the data for this star, but the red is the scaled solar abundances for these elements. So whatever it is that's making the R process, it's very robust across time and metallicity. It's something that's uniquely happening in the universe because here's the sun, a very different star from this star, and it's having the same behavior. And this is now just showing you some of the Gunn-Peterson studies from Zhaohui Fan's webpage, showing you the Lyman alpha emission line from the quasars and how the IGM appears to be truly going black, emitting very letting through very little flux, blueward of there. And the claim is that it's not just this, but the consistency with the Lyman beta Gunn-Peterson trough that is leading you to believe that the IGM is really experiencing a change in ionization at these redshifts. And I know Peng O talked last week about Lyman gamma trough as well. And here is the WMAP data, and this is the likelihood functions for the cosmological parameters. And what I would like to just emphasize on this slide is just the very broad likelihood distribution of tau, and note how the value that's selected is really skewed relative to the broadness of the distribution. Like I said, if you start to focus on the lower end of this, if you have just what's observed as far as Gunn-Peterson studies, and you add in some X-rays at higher redshift, you would be consistent with the lower envelope. Been a lot of studies talking about reasons that the primordial stellar IMF, why should have been biased towards higher masses, greater than about 100 solar masses, owing primarily to the physics of the cooling in primordial gas. And like Jason's talked about, stellar feedback on the matter that's accreting onto the primordial stars can complicate this. And Tan and McKee in particular have been talking about how, you might have to cut the IMF off at about 30 solar masses, so maybe having the lower end be there rather than, say, a 1 or a 10. So instead of, it's just a it's sort of a definition issue. Instead of saying top heavy, you might rather wish to say it's lacking in low mass stars. But there is, a physical difference in the less than 140, greater than 140 regime. So these hypotheses can still be tested. And it's thought that the primordial IMF ceases to be top-heavy at gas transition metallicities of about 10 to the minus 4 solar. And there's people in this room, like Raffaella and Andrea, also Vorka Brahman collaborators, that have worked on this problem. So there's a lot of ideas here about what's going on at the high redshift universe. And I know that a lot of us have really spent time thinking about this very hard. And it might have appeared that things are confusing and that we're changing our mind often. But it is true that I'm going to go on to my impression of what my my work with my collaborators, what I would say our current bottom line is, and like Jason has emphasized, it should not be taken as the field's consensus, because this is still rapidly evolving with a lot of back and forth, as you saw from the previous slide. So, but I would say, that the current bottom line is that you do not necessarily need these parent stability supernovae to explain the very data that's sometimes used to motivate it, reionization, the metal abundances, and particularly in this laboratory in our galactic backyard, the metal poor halo stars. And the idea is that they cannot have dominated at high redshifts, that you do need stars of mass about 3 to 40 solar masses at redshifts 10 to 20. But you could have had them be present coevally, they just cannot have dominated. So that's the bottom line. And I'm basing this on data from rather extreme environments like the broad emission line regions and quasars to relatively well quiescent environments like some of the IGM absorbers. And the caveat is that, of course, this is very heavily dependent on stellar evolution models. That the ionizing spectra have converged to within 10%, but the stellar yields can still vary a lot.
Well, when you say EMS cannot have dominated, what?
They cannot have been the sole or dominant mode of star formation. They cannot have formed exclusively at redshifts 10 to.
Dominated the star formation, right?
Right, the
photoproduction or metal production.
Even earlier than that, I think they cannot have formed exclusively. As far as the hydrogen ionizing rate, you don't really need go if you're working back from the data. You can generate, and I'll try to show this. You can generate sufficiently high tau to.
So you're ionizing photons.
Yes, but also, like Jason has mentioned, the other laboratories of nucleosynthesis include.
The statement I would make is that they cannot have dominated the early production of iron.
Mm. Well, and from our paper, Andrea, they cannot. There's the nitrogen and carbon and other issues. So I really think it's a question of whether they can have exclusively existed. That is, if the universe doesn't transition away from the metal-free regime, in principle, they should have exclusively existed. And I'm saying they cannot have because there's a lot of observations that you would be hard to explain if they had exclusively existed at these epochs. That's, yeah.
It's very difficult to rule out, at some low level, contributions from the VMS. But it's clear that most of the iron did come.
As a first step, if we try to look at what the ionizing efficiencies of the first stars could be, and we look simply at the metals that are observed in the IGM and we use a number of stellar evolution models and try to associate and derive the minimum number of ionizing photons per baryon that could have been generated in association with what you already see, we find a couple of interesting things. The first is, as I mentioned, metal-free stars have greater ionizing photon yields and less metals, so they tend to be 10 to 20 times more efficient at generating ionizing radiation per metal yield than solar metallicity stars. And this will really help for reionization at early epochs. The second is that VMS, because they're copious producers of not just ionizing radiation, but also of metals, I think their weighted yield is something like a half of the mass of the star comes out in metals. They may generate only a third ionizing photon per baryon before they self-pollute their gas cloud on these seas, forming at these transition metallicities. And you really need a order of few to 10 ionizing photons per baryon. So again, the indication is that perhaps they could not have dominated, because if they did, they could not have been relevant for reionization from these calculations. But like I said, it's possible that they existed coevally, and I'm just talking about they cannot have existed exclusively. And we also looked, Andrea and Rafa and I, at quasar broad emission line regions, and I think Rafa talked about this a little last week already, so I'll go through this fast. But essentially, we were trying to reproduce the different ratios of elements, because they're produced on different time scales. Iron, magnesium, nitrogen, and carbon come from different parts of the IMF and therefore have different evolutionary time scales, and we were trying to constrain the IMF from that. And the advantage of ratios is that, of course, you become independent of a lot of unknown astrophysics in these star-forming regions at higher redshift. And I'll just show you one graph, the nitrogen to carbon ratio. This blue line here is from parent stability supernovae. The red line is from solar metallicity, the dashed line from zero metallicity stars. These two are for present-day Salpeter IMF 1 to 100 solar masses. The blue box is what's observed from redshift 0 to about 6. And I just want to point out the severe underproduction by parent stability supernovae off nitrogen, although, like I've said already, this could change in the future. But it does appear that you need intermediate mass stars to have existed at redshifts about 10, at least above about 7, to get the right N to C ratio at lower redshift. And finally, one interesting laboratory are the clues from the local relics. The idea is that the ashes from the first supernovae are locked into these local ultra-metal-poor halo stars, and a lot of these elements cannot have been self-synthesized in these low-mass stars. And it appears, and I think Jason's shown you this already, that the yield patterns of Iron Peak and our process elements are not matched by individual, like a single-shot parent stability supernova, or any individual supernovae. The hypernovae plots he showed were already IMF-weighted, am I correct, Jason?
No, they're just a
Yeah, but we didn't have a...
There was no IMF plot.
No, but I'm saying it wasn't a single hypernova, right? It was a range of masses. Okay, so the abundance ratios indicate that hypernovae from metal-free stars of mass about 8 to 40 solar masses are better, still not perfect, but better at meshing the data. It's worth emphasizing, it's not like these models are free of fine-tuning. You need to do that as well, of which, of course, the explosion energy is an important one. There's also, you play a lot with mass cuts and so on. And this is a big uncertainty, but if you want to construct a primordial IMF that is lacking in VMS, hypernovae become very important, because what we're trying to do is match all these different constraints and see what mass range might be relevant for a first star's IMF. And just to put up this plot again and to reemphasize that no single parent stability supernova can explain the data, and again, just the iron peak elements, particularly zinc, you have some difficulty. And this is 63 metal poor halo stars with iron over H ranging from about 1/100th to 1/10,000th solar. So I'd like to spend a little time on this plot. The strength of this approach, which is to connect the nucleosynthetic and ionizing photon signature, is that starting with the data on the previous page where we were looking at matching these different models, you can use that to then construct an IMF for reionization and ask how well does that do. So here's the lifetime integrated ionizing photons per baryon, or ionizing efficiency, versus the stellar mass. And this black curve is for hydrogen, metal-free, and this curve is for fiducial pop 2. This curve is for helium, and here the shaded regions show you where the hypernova regime is versus black hole regime versus the parent stability regime. And what I'd like you to note here is, first of all, the sharp rise from 10 to 50 solar masses, and that it peaks for hydrogen before 120 solar masses. So you don't need to go to the VMS regime to get a strong ionizing efficiency. And that an IMF that precludes these low mass stars can do just as well as one that exists just to the right of this, a VMS IMF. Of course, for helium-2, the production keeps on rising, but that's since we're dominantly probing hydrogen reionization with the data, this is what I'd like you to focus on. This range here gives you an idea of what these numbers would be directly from these curves if you convolved an IMF. So in that sense, Andrea, if you had a Salpeter IMF, yes, this point would go up here and maybe contribute almost as equally as some of this. So maybe Paul has to buy you dinner, although he has left, right?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah, so, and when we use this nucleosynthetic motivated IMF for reionization, you put it through a reionization code, we find that a saltpeter slope IMF from 10 to 140 solar masses that's simply just lacking in low mass stars, as current studies indicate, can generate sufficiently high taus for the CMB if about 10 to 15%. There's this paper by Max Tegmark that jointly analyzed Sloan data with the WMAP data, and they got that the most likely tau is closer to 12% rather than 17%. But for if you assume, you know, this is not even assuming unreasonable astrophysical parameters, it's very reasonable escape fractions of ionizing radiation and so on. And all we need is for metal-free star formation to last anywhere from 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 years. So we actually have a semi-analytic, an analytic calculation justifying these timescales in our paper. So we didn't just pull this out of a hat. So let me just move on for the last few minutes, just talking a little bit about a problem that's become more and more interesting to me, which is the relative propagation timescales of metals and ionizing radiation from the first halos and how they influence each other. Now, as some of you may be aware, to explain the IGM metallicity, people have invoked two classes of metal transport models, one of which are primarily driven by supernovae, and the other is ejection through galaxy mergers. And there's all kinds of interesting effects associated with this, not just reionization, but feedback for structure formation and so on. But metal ejection turns out to be very, very difficult, actually. Although most simulations and semi-analytic studies find that they can do it, reproducing the exact distribution might be difficult, especially with overdensities like we saw last week, and mergers might do better. And so this field is still unresolved, and it's likely to result in a very inhomogeneous distribution of IGM metallicities, which is, of course, what's seen. But part of the reason that ejecting metals uniformly out to the true IGM is so hard is because stellar scales to IGM scales is roughly equal to the scales of an atom to this room. Now, the density contrast is nowhere as great here as it is here, but still, we're talking very large distances, and it is very difficult. So let me just show you a couple of images from Nick and Naden simulations. This is at redshift 9, and this galaxy is about a 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 solar mass galaxy that's sitting in relative isolation, doesn't go through a lot of mergers. This is the density, temperature, supernova 2 metals, so not none from other types of supernovae, and the hydrogen neutral fraction. And what I'd like you to take away from this, now here, I believe this is 50 kiloparsecs here, the scale. And what I'd like you to take away from these two plots is the ionizing photons get out just fine, but the supernova 2 metals are still trapped down there. And this is a close-up down to about 6 kiloparsecs, showing you that. And you come to a stage where reionization is essentially approaching completion down to redshifts about 6.5. But you see the same thing. The galaxy has sufficiently ionized the IGM around it. Now, this is just a small cut of a larger simulation. But you see again that the supernova 2 metals have really remained trapped in the core. So it's unclear. I'm sorry?
Why are they trapped?
He finds that I think it's a number of things. He has a star formation efficiency that I think just by the time these are generated, that it's that just where the ifrons have gone out way ahead, but it's basically bounded by where he's forming the stars, and it's just basically trapped in the dense part of the galaxy. They just don't get out.
The envelope slows down and getting to the cooling phase.
Yeah, yes, and he does not manage to get out. In fact, he has put in a lot of chemistry as well, trying to see if this could affect where the ionizing photons can get on, what they do for the chemistry. Yeah.
The gas density will lower when we get out.
Yeah, although he has this actually for some smaller systems.
I'm surprised that the temperature is very low. Sensitive 4K.
So it must be in a cooling phase.
Yeah, I mean, he has continuous star formation though. He doesn't.
Is there an explosion somewhere? Or
yeah,
or this for the ionization?
Oh, no. I mean, he has, I don't think he has, like, sort of episodic star formation. I think he has them going off continuously, so.
But he's dumping hydrodynamic energy?
Yes, yes, yeah.
Shocks.
Yeah, no, he just finds that where he forms stars is set by some other stuff, like his chemistry and the over-densities. But where they end up forming, right, they're not able to get up because they just get trapped and cool too quickly, so. Yeah.
There's no hot gas.
I mean, this is the wind model, but there's no sign of any
kind of. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The more massive ones, it's trapped.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll come back to this. It's Nick's work. Very quickly, of course, the flip side of metal transport is the self-pollution timescales of these first galaxies. How quickly does it take for metals to rain back and self-enrich star-forming regions? And there's been semi-analytic and numerical studies of this problem. And let me just show you one slide from a paper that I've been involved with at Keiichi Iwata, where we looked at 3D gas hydro simulations, and we really wanted to look at the chemodynamical effects of the first supernovae with a clumpy ISM. And I would say the strength of this paper was looking at ISM scales. We looked down to like a few kiloparsecs, and we put in a metal-free starburst for what we thought might be a typical first halo, 10 to the 8 solar masses or so. Now this is a XY view of the galaxy, and this is so the top-down view, this is the YZ view, these are both density, and this is metals here, YZ. And what we found is that if you did not have a strong starburst, we found this effect that hadn't been predicted in previous works, which is that a low-level starburst, say like 100 supernovae in a galaxy of this mass in the center, could actually trigger a collapse of the metals back. Basically, it would drive a metal outflow, create a chimney, but then that chimney would lose the support from being driven by supernovae, and it would cool and collapse back in, and it would return the metals to the central star-forming regions on scales of tens of millions of years or 10 million years. So it was another interesting effect we found was that the metallicity then of the second generation star formation, about 10 to the minus 4 solar, is very close to what's predicted by some of these, some of the works on the transition metallicity. Okay, so let me just end, because I think we've talked enough about first stars and their signatures. I'll leave you with some open questions. How closely does IGM metal enrichment track reionization? Like I've talked about, how unique or sharp is this transition from a primordial to present-day IMF? And the cosmological relevance of metal-free stars. How long can they keep forming? Which is why I think these continued studies of how long metal-free star formation can last are very important. And can we see them with future telescopes? Are the ionizing photons going to escape mostly or get trapped? And we hope that at least in some environments they do get trapped, because we, you know, would love to see them through some of these emission line signatures that Jason talked about. Also, the role played by dust for this problem. The improvements in stellar models could change a lot of these predictions. I think that's really worth highlighting again. And finally, I just wanted to throw this out there as a wild card, whether the first stars have to form in the first galaxy, because there are more and more extragalactic H2 regions that are found in the local universe. This is from the SINGS survey. It's an H-alpha selected survey. I believe, these are the H2 regions that are circled, but these are seen anywhere from a few to tens of kiloparsecs away. And these are just like a few stars, like a few O stars, but with a very strong H2 region. So nobody really understands how these came to be. So I just wanted to throw that out there. No, they haven't. I think they said, I think this paper was like 2004, and they said they were going to follow it up. As far as I know, no, they haven't, but it's just interesting. The first author is Emma Ryan Weber.
It's an over the
H1. But
it
has O3.
But he said helium, right?
But it's metal-free, it can't be O3.
No, of course. Okay. No, I'm just saying, oh, right, and this is the local universe, so this isn't.
Okay.
No, I'm just saying, I find this interesting that they are so removed, and they've really looked quite deep in hydrogen too.
H1?
Yeah, I mean...
Does the H1 go out to that H2 region?
No, it does. I mean, I think they've, I don't have the contours here. Yeah, like, they've actually convolved this. I think it's, this particular one shows some H1 contours, but I forget what the expansion of SINGS is, survey for ionization and neutral gas, and but it's a H-alpha selected survey, but the subset is, they do have H1 and optical data for a lot of this, so I just wanted to throw this out there. So let me just put up my conclusion slide and stop here and take questions if you guys like to ask me anything.
Thank you.